Welcome to the Eucatastrophe, where we meander through politics, pop culture, church, and society to consider true human ends and how life may be enchanted. I'm Joel Harrison, joined as always by my co-host here, Dave Taylor. Dave and I have just been catching up a little bit, talking about the things as grumpy old men that really make us angry. But I thought I'd ask you instead. We had 2 weeks of not recording as we went away and did various things. Dave, what did you get up to?
I started seeing a therapist. And I told you this before, and your first question you asked me about it, did I come up?
And then what did you say?
I said, why do I keep having these dreams that he's breastfeeding me?
Oh, man. Now all I want to know is what your therapist thinks of the podcast.
Oh, gosh. I don't think they're up for that.
Just rehashing.
She did ask me. She was asking me what I did my theses on for my honors and my masters. And I said, the first one was on loneliness. And the second one was on abandonment. And then she picked up a notepad and started writing.
as you might. Gosh. Well, we're not actually going to just be reliving the past 2 weeks of absence that we've had and loneliness, because we're back together now, Dave. So good to see you. Yeah.
It's fine to see you.
We're talking this week and next week about a book by James Davis Hunter called To Change the World, The Irony, Tragedy, and Possibility of Christianity in the Late Modern World. This was published in 2010. Now, Hunter is a very prominent sociologist at the University of Virginia, and he's the one who first coined the term culture wars in the 1990s. This book is really interesting and I think fertile for a lot of discussion, both to stimulate our conversations, but also some critical edges as well. He writes against, in this book, to give you a bit of an overlay and then elaborate on what we're going to discuss, particularly this week and next week. So Hunter in this book is writing against two related impulses in Christian public action or witness. First of all, he's writing against the understanding that culture exists within the hearts and minds of individuals, that then what cultural change is ultimately is individual change of the person. And then he says, secondly, that this focus on individuals and cultural change through them ultimately and paradoxically leads Christians to emphasize politics, that is lawmakers, judges, and policy wonks, as the vehicle for Christian witness. Now, in contrast to these two problems, or ideas or arguments, he develops two responses or two arguments in response. First of all, rather than cultural change arising through individuals, he says that cultural change requires institutions, networks, and cultivating forms of power. And then secondly, rather than the harmful focus of that Christians in the contemporary period have on politics as their form of witness, across what he describes as the right, the left, and also even neo-Baptist traditions, Christians instead should be cultivating what he calls faithful presence. So this book contains really interesting discussion on a number of things, including developing some of Hunter's ideas of culture wars, how both left and right he sees using of Christians using an individualistic register and reducing Christianity to a special interest group. And I think that's something that we'll probably come back to at some stage to discuss notions of culture wars, especially as they apply both largely outside of the United States and our context also potentially. So we may return to that idea and some of the ideas in this book. But what we're going to focus on, I think, is the two core ideas or arguments. And this is part of our attempt to occasionally try and map out how different Christians are thinking about how to be engaged in public political witness in our contemporary period, right? So those two arguments, again, what is needed for cultural change on Hunter's account. And then next week, we're going to look at his argument around faithful presence and what I think is an anti-politics that grounds it. So we're looking then at his notion of cultural change. And what he responds, what he is challenging is what he characterizes as a generally individualistic focus, one that then turns into forms of pietism, idealism, and insularity within Christian culture. Now, he opens his book with this wonderful and quite scathing discussion of how Christians seem to understand cultural change, at least popularly speaking. Now, we have to put a caveat on this, and I think we'll come back to this a little bit, is that he is writing in the American context, and he is an evangelical writing largely around evangelicals as well. But he's responding to this idea that culture exists within the hearts and minds of individuals and the values they adopt. And he focuses in on how Christians have this seemingly this singular focus on worldview talk, broadly the ideas or set of values that lie behind a person's actions. And that leads to the claim that cultural problems must be treated as a problem of ideas conversion, or else the problem internally for Christians is that they're just not thinking rigorously enough. If they just had the right worldview in place, then individuals would make better choices and culture would then be renewed through that individual bottom-up approach. And he says ultimately that's obviously individualistic. It's focused on the individual's conversion to these ideas, this worldview. And it's also pietistic, and the idea being that you simply need to shape up rightly to get it be more rigorously formed in your worldview education, for example. And so he has this great discussion about all this worldview explosion courses that especially I think happen, I would say, in the more early 2000s or around 2010 as up to 2010 and so on as well. Frequent appeals to Wilberforce, for example, as an exemplary figure of someone who had his worldview right. And then what the idea being then is once you have your worldview, you'll then go out and exercise your vote correctly, right? You'll vote in the people who also share the correct worldview. Now, that's his understanding of that's the lay of the land of the problem, that how Christians understand cultural change. From the individual, be rigorously formed in your worldview, go out and vote appropriately to then put in place the right persons. That's what he is challenging in this book. Now, I had an initial question here, which me being a New Zealander and new to this land of Australia, thought Dave could possibly much better contribute to as to whether that kind of understanding of cultural change through worldview and individual conversion and voting, whether that some of those ideas you think are actually have been or are prominent in Australia.
Whether the idea that in terms of his understanding of culture being the sum total of the worldviews present or the values present in individuals, or that we need to have as many people kind of colonized with the right ideas as possible.
Well, he sees the two as connected, right?
Yeah.
So you engage and people need to have the right thinking or the right conversion.
Yep.
And then then that happens both at the political level, but then the person at the base level, the base populace, will also vote in the right people on the basis also.
So I think
and also just this general idea doesn't, that the focus is on getting the right thinking or getting the right paradigm.
Sure. So my, you know, I have a limited experience as far as the church in Australia goes and things like that. But my sense is that it doesn't quite map onto Australian politics and kind of religious life as much, because there was never a sense that we were a dominant force in the way that Americans seem to conceive of Christianity being kind of the moral or political authority in the land kind of thing. In my experience, we never thought that we had it in the way that, by it I mean political and cultural influence. There was to a certain extent, and I'm sure there's all sorts of counterexamples, but I don't think it kind of quite maps on in that way. Now, there's certainly, even earlier, late 90s, early 2000s, there was a lot of talk about the importance of a biblical worldview and things like that. There was lots of training courses popping up all over the place about how to do X, Y, and Z according to biblical principles and things like that. So that was certainly a strong feature. And also, I just don't think we are as invested in political leaders in Australia as they are in America. So I found it fascinating. I thought that his book was much more recent than 2010, because it's quite a fascinating description of the Trump phenomenon, because this sense that a culture is just made up of or embedded in individual minds and hearts, and that being kind of transferred also onto the political realm. So you need the strong man, the strong usually a man, the strong individual who has both the strength of personality and the principles and worldview necessary to be our guy on the inside. That is a perfect description of kind of Trumpism.
You don't think it
but in Australia, I don't know. I don't think anybody expects as much. Even ScoMo, even though I think there is a lot of sense that, especially amongst charismatics and things like that, that he is representing us finally and things like that. I don't think we are as invested, the dwarf Christians are as invested in him as an American would be in an American politician.
I think that's interesting. I think it's certainly the case that this is writing in a context where there was that, as you said, that explosion of worldview sort of thinking.
Like Australians don't expect politicians to be able to achieve things. I don't think. Right. Don't you? I think that's a big difference.
Right.
Like we don't expect, even though Tony Abbott, for example, was a great figurehead to a certain type of conservatism, for example, and ScoMo being a more, cuddly version of that same similar conservatism, we just don't expect that he will be able to assert his will.
So my impression as someone recently arrived here is that actually Australia increasingly looks like the United States in ways, and that
right.
a lot of this is sort of shifting in that direction towards an understanding of. So you said, for example, that people haven't felt that they're alienated in the way, or they were dominant and then they were alienated.
Mm.
So Hunter, in his book, he says a lot of the focus on why both left, right Christians and of different stripes, or they're not of different stripes because he says they're similar in some ways. Is that they both operate out of a resentment, right? The idea that they're resentful, they're angry because they feel a sense of alienation and a loss of power and a loss of sense that they are reflected in politics, right?
Yeah.
And so then you get the left and the American left of people like Sojourners and Jim Wallis and so on. They'll write about how basically they're trying to become operatives in the Democratic Party sort of thing. Or you'll get the right, obviously, there as well. So various people that will say, we need to vote. Now you see it in Trump, right?
Mm.
We need to get him into power for the right Supreme Court justices and these sorts of things. But I think that increasingly that there's an element of that here as well, that there is an element of, okay, the culture is shifting rapidly on us. I'm not saying this is amongst everyone, but there is those sort of things bubbling away as a paradigm that some people are trying to put forward as a matter of how to engage politically. And
there is a general sense of more conservative people feeling like that, I think. I don't know how representative that is of the church in general. And again, this is very much shaped by my own experiences because I was converted into a context where people saw themselves as in exile. So, we had a responsibility to influence as best we could and to preserve the culture and the society as best we could. But in the end, it's all going up in ash.
Yeah, see, I think you're probably right. Like, and obviously there's nuances amongst different communities and groups.
Mm.
But like, for example, take the debate over same-sex marriage.
Mm.
What did people start doing as a matter of Christian voice in that space? What did they do? They drew out someone like Ryan Anderson, who's from the Heritage Foundation in the United States, to do public speaking and so on. And then you have like workshops, which I went to, one of these in the United States. I thought I was going to learn about certain scholars. Turns out it was more like a toolkit for the culture wars sort of stuff. And I think that sort of thing is in certain contexts it's happening.
Yeah.
And it's focused as well on, getting your worldview right. If you listen to John Anderson, the former deputy prime minister,
it's
the same talk.
He was someone I was going to point to actually.
Same talk at every place. It's about we need a new Wilberforce sort of thing, right?
Yeah. What about Mike Baird as well, our former premier. He does some similar stuff like that.
Yeah.
Less overt. There was a real strong sense amongst Sydney Anglicans actually in New South. Mike Baird being the premier of New South Wales, which is the state that we're in, has a very conservative Anglican diocese in Sydney. Basically, he was a bit of a messianic figure for
us.
In a way that I hadn't seen amongst my tribe so much.
Yeah. I mean,
maybe you're right. Maybe it is emerging as an
organization. I think we've talked about this, at least you and I have before, wedding was at that talk, and I asked them the question, how do you understand the relationship between the executive, you being a representative of the executive, and the churches?
Yeah.
And he said, well, I'm a good Christian.
Wasn't it something like political theology? Well, people think that you can't be a Christian and a good politician.
That's right.
I think it's okay.
Yeah, I think it's okay to be a Christian. And yeah. I was like, right, okay, so good. Anyway, so the other element that he emphasizes, Hunter, is insularity, which I thought is interesting. Now, this may be more American, but he talks about evangelical culture production in the United States is entirely oriented towards the faithful or sort of subcultures, right? Yeah. Offering little, he says, of a common vocabulary for a shared life that's informed by the faith and not exclusive to it. And he says it basically degenerates into a form of popular pitch and market instrumentalism to sort of create your own goods in the market. And so there's no real production of anything that is actually engaging with the wider spheres of culture and society. Now, I thought that's fascinating. I think in the Australian context, you'd have to translate and say the difficulty is that there may be very little centres of cultural production, full stop.
In Australia?
Yeah, as in you can't really talk about. So this gets onto his theory of change. Mm. His theory of cultural change is it focuses on centres of power or things that are just on the periphery of the centres of power. So he says, New York Times is more important than some local newspaper, for example, things like this. Or he says, Yale is more important than other universities. So these places are predominantly where culture shifting happens. Mm. And he says often slightly on the periphery of these because then you're challenging the dominant thing that's going on in that place. And I thought, this is fascinating because it's very difficult to identify centres in Australia as a matter of federal politics. We talk Canberra is the center, but Canberra is almost like it's not quite a non-place, but it's certainly not a Washington DC or a London or something like that, right?
Well, the ABC, do you think, as a center of cultural production, communication and things like that?
Okay, well then that raises a question, right? So on his argument, so let's go then straight to what he understands as what culture change requires, right? He thinks it requires centres, that's being slightly on the periphery maybe of those centres in order to challenge the dominant orthodox understanding within them. Mm. It requires networks of persons, he says, rather than an individual conversion, as it were. And it requires cultivating symbolic capital. Mm. He gives us an example like the Rhodes Scholarship, having a symbolic capital import.
Yeah.
And he says change then is really bottom-up. Okay. Very rarely bottom up, but actually entails these networks operating in these contexts. Now, as an example, and I think we can challenge what he's saying, and I know you have some deep reservations, but as an example, I think this has some value to it when he talks about the church fathers, right, the patristics, and he says, with very few exceptions, they were born into families that were typically prosperous, highly educated, high social standing. They were extraordinarily erudite with the quality of output, and they transformed the Roman conception of paideia, which was a formation for citizenship. They changed that into co-opting it into essentially formation for serving the community of the church. And he says what they also did, though, was that the church hierarchy essentially took over imperial authority in the sense that bishops became centers of authority that engaged with imperial life and so on, but never at the expense of community interests and so on. So, there's an element there of actually these were a form of elite that was nevertheless at the service of others, right?
Yeah.
Now, that's one example he gives, and he gives others about popes who basically held authority in Rome when it was under siege. Mm. He talks about the Reformation as well, using various networks between nobility and church thinkers and so on. And all these pointing to that that cultural change requires essentially what he's almost saying is there's networks of erudite people that are going to be serving people, that are going to be leading, that are going to be joining with. So he gives examples. For example, I think you can contrast with the Benedict option, right? Yeah. Which we've talked about is very flat, you know, this idea we just go into exile.
Yeah.
When he actually gives, I think, a more adequate description of monastic movements where they were sent out as incredibly learned.
Yeah.
And yes, they engaged for the community, but one of the things that they explicitly did was that they worked with the nobility as a form of patronage,
yeah.
Right? So that then, you know, they had these kind
and debated
multiple,
with.
And multiple steps yeah. of engagement, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, that's what he's saying. So when you say the ABC, I'm thinking, yeah, well then if you're talking in the Australian context about how, on Hunter's account, how you would engage in cultural change, then it would look very interesting for how you engage with the ABC.
Yeah, but I just don't know. As a general proposition, yeah, I get that a big way in which Christendom formed was through a Christian intelligentsia that could engage in debate with cultural elites like philosophers, druidic figures, spiritual leaders, and things like that, demonstrate the superiority of Christianity over and against some other philosophical system or some other set of gods and things like that.
Well, I don't know if it's just, I don't know if it's pure apologetic in that sort of way. I think it's more about also that they were engaged explicitly in the formation of a culture as well. So that they actually formed communities, and in the case of bishops and church fathers, they actually engaged with imperial authority as well, engaged with the acts of governance, or they engaged with acts of power.
Yeah,
they weren't, you know, as well as, you know, feeding the hungry, caring to the sick, and so on. In fact, the former was conducive to the latter, as partly I think what he's arguing here.
So, but my problem is in Australian culture, I just don't know who these figures would be, who are the generators of culture and things like that. And actually, as I was reading through some of the things that you wanted to talk about today, I was thinking, well, how does the kind of dominant kind of cultural, ethical, and political worldview enter into my consciousness? And for me, it's through engagement with comedy. So I listen to a huge amount of comedy podcasts. I watch a lot of comedy stand-up comedy. I watch a lot of comedy movies and TV shows and things like that, and a lot of Australian stuff of that, that kind of thing. So Australian comedy podcasts, Australian comedy shows, and it's actually through finding myself laughing at things. That's how I understand. Oh, actually, my values and worldview are being shaped or being challenged, or and things like that. And that was the closest I could come to think of some equivalent as a epistemic structure in our culture.
For something that is the equivalent. So you're saying like the equivalent of a kind of, engagement with an elite level of center of authorities and so on in Australian context is humor.
It's humor, yeah.
Right.
I would say so. Yeah. And even it gets a bit much sometimes and it borders on sanctimonious and all this, but all of our comedy is political and a lot of our political commentary is satirical as well and playful and things like that. So I can't think of how I would apply this work to our context in this way, apart from doing something, and this is why this is kind of another way in which I'd like to push back against some of. So one of my problems with this kind of program is that it's so.
Did you say pogrom?
Yeah. It's a program. We're meant to be liquidating populations, aren't we? It's too. I just don't think Christianity or Christendom was a pre-planned project in the way that this is.
Yeah.
It seemed to be the outworking of the logic of Christianity coming into contact with particular political structures. It wasn't like Constantine conceived of this thing called Christendom and then planned out
all the bishops went in and thought, how do we as a network of elites start cultivating culture?
And so this is why I think, and we'll talk about this.
Sociologist.
Yes. So
this is partly, I think, the sociological mindset, right? So looking at history and finding logic and laws within it.
Whereas me, who I do some philosophy of history and history of ideas things, one of the things that that approach to study did for me was it made me very suspicious of people who think that things are replicable from epoch to epoch, or that there can be parallels created between different epochs in ways that are straightforward or streamlined and things like that. So that's a hesitation. And I think, and we'll talk about this next episode a bit more, I think, we just need to do the logic of Christianity better, I think. And so that ties into what he's talking about. We need to value things like truth, forms of association, forms of love and all that type of things, and creatively doing Christianity better, but without the without attempting to recreate something from an age gone by.
What I think you're pointing out here, because actually what you just described could fit easily with what we'll discuss next week, right? Yes. This conception of faithful presence,
yes.
Although there are complications, I think. But what I think you're pointing out is in whether what you're describing actually fits then with the first part of his book, which is describing how cultural change happens.
Mm.
And he does have a description of cultural change happening that does have within it more of a thick conception of how you engage almost as political animals, right?
Yeah.
And the possible logics you can do for that. And I think in fairness to him, I think there is. I mean, I have a little more sympathy, although
I don't want to be saying that. I think I've got so much out of that, the essay of it that I read.
Yeah.
I think it's really fantastic and worth reading.
So my sympathy is that I think that we don't typically account for enough how we already live within and enmeshed within forms of elitism, right? Or
yeah,
forms
sure.
of leadership of some kind. And how we need to, then we can't escape that, and how that has to be then directed towards wisdom or virtue or the common good or leadership for the sake of, you know, others, right? Self-sacrificial, yeah. Self-atoning, you know, these sorts of ideas,
okay.
Right? So, for example, just to take a really basic point from, like, you know, public law context, we have a civil service.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
We have
yeah.
an entire executive apparatus that in many respects doesn't change with the change of government.
Yeah, right.
Right? These things exist and they operate from creating huge amounts of policy and these sorts of things, right?
Yeah.
Now, you know, how is that engaged with? For example, you know, that just one example, there will always be elements of, you know, that aren't entirely, you know, bottom-up democratic. And in fact, I think there are problems when we start thinking of, and I think some people do think of change is just sort of about popular movements.
Yeah.
Because I think what you see at the present actually is that popular movements are usually successful or co-opted by strong executives or
yeah.
strong forms of leadership,
well,
right?
Well, that's what I was going to, not just strong forms of leadership. So I was thinking, you know, take some examples of elites in our society. So academics, for example, or politicians. In both those instances, it's not just the leadership of the institutions that they're embedded in that's problematic. I don't know whether it is problematic at all or not. It's actually the bureaucracy that prevents them from showing agency. The bureaucratization, the full bureaucratization of the academy, so that you have constraints on the types of things that you can say, the types of research that's worth doing, all these types of things. All these things rob academics of their agency as elites and public intellectuals.
That would, I guess, be a caveat to it.
And the same thing I think could be said about politics in a similar way, which actually prevents the person of good conscience actually having any efficacy in the way that the people that this book is criticizing.
So that's fascinating, because you could say something if you're...
it's the rule of no one is what...
Well, exactly. Yeah. What you're building out there, you could say something like, on his account, you need a network of persons that are engaging and rooted in particular places, typically at the centers or on the periphery of them and so on. And on your point there, you could be saying even that may be entirely unsuccessful because there is... an intransigent sclerotic kind of...
Because we're not the sum of all of our individual parts as say, members of the academy, right? We're not just a conglomerate of all the individuals. We have created this super person called the bureaucracy that goes beyond the sum total of all the individuals making up the academy. And so somehow you have to resist that non-person personhood thing that's actually controlling the show.
So it's
non-participation in that somehow.
I think this actually is something we'll pick up next week, okay. because his conception of the state and of power, of civil authority, is very much based on it having some sort of logic that is about, you know, negotiating the power between individuals, or something that is quite negative, I think, or quite so you know, there's something like what you're describing there, I think, is something that if you were to engage in cultural change as a thinking it through as Christians and so on, then you'd have to tackle what you're describing.
Yes.
And I think you'd equally have to tackle the understanding of the state that supports what you're saying as
absolutely.
Well. And so I think his understanding of the state actually has real problems, but we'll get to that. The last thing I wanted to say, because I know you have reservations about it, but so this thinking, so this idea here we've got here about cultural change that he's put forward. It's not individual based. It's not about the conversion of different people and then voting in certain individuals into power. So that they can then reflect you back to yourself, these sorts of things, right? It's not about just the conversion of an individual mind, but requires networks of people that are operating at multiple levels of power in the center and so on. Now, the back of this book has Tim Keller with an endorsement on it, right? And there is...
I didn't know we were going to name names.
No, but it's fascinating because when I visited... when I lived in New York and I visited a friend at Redeemer, you really did get the sense that it was partially about exchanging business cards.
Right.
You know, there really was a sense of,
that's what our synod's for, isn't it?
Yeah. Others have talked about this as well, right? You go to these events and it was about, now you could dress that up as forming networks that are going to be, you know, change makers and these sorts of things. But there is a real sense in which, okay, these are quite privileged people who have gone through the right universities, moved to a cosmopolitan center, and then they're continuing in similar vein. And then this precipitates what some have described as forms of gated communities in which your children will go through this and so on. So there is a real a real danger there that it can just be entirely complicit with status quo.
That's right, because we don't have our class structure even is different. And American class structure is different to what the situation was at the formation of Christendom. Because we're ruled by the bourgeoisie. They're the opinion makers. They're not an aristocracy. They don't have the elite values of an aristocracy that can be engaged with using kind of Christian philosophical principles. Yeah. They just want to buy shit. Like, so how do you
create an aristocracy?
How do you create networks of
virtue?
Virtue using a class of people who
have been cultivated to climb the ladder.
Yep, and whose existence is predicated on consumption. I've deep kind of political.
Yeah. Now his then says it requires formation and into what he describes as faithful presence. But I think there is always that little bit of a hint that there is a danger. Like, I totally believe that actually Christian witness, political, public, and so on has to be multi-layered.
Yeah.
And it does have to engage at these multiple levels, and it does have to think about, well, how do you cultivate precisely that sort of leadership and so on, but for the people and the kind of deep, rich sense of solidarity and so on.
Yeah.
Now, whether faithful presence, what he articulates, is enough, that's a subject we'll come to next week.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for listening to my... existential angst over all this as I try and work out what I actually think about any of this. Thank you so
much. Didn't we have an episode where we tried to place you in the class structure and we just couldn't? You just fell outside of everything. You're a man unto yourself.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us. Please follow us on the social medias. You can find us on Facebook by searching The Eucatastrophe. You can find us on Twitter at UCAT, that's EUCAT _ podcast. Please share us, drop us a review. It really helps us to get exposure and things like that. We will talk to you next week as we continue our discussion of this fascinating book and the topic of faithful presence. See you then.